annoyingly bunching up beneath her belt and overlapping belly. She was glad Jende had talked her out of wearing high heels. Her legs were shaky enough on the 2-inch cowgirl boots into which she'd tucked her jeans. Shaky or not, though, she had to make herself at ease and act as if she went to places like this every night. After she becomes a pharmacist, she might have to attend lots of parties with white people. Hopefully her accent will no longer be as strong as one of her professors had said it is. Maybe she'll learn to speak with an American accent by then. But for tonight, she would try to speak as slowly as she could, and then smile. No one would ask her to repeat herself 3 times if she just smiled. For perhaps a minute after re-entering the bar, she couldn't see Jende or Winston, so she stood by herself, looking around the room at friends and co-workers and couples whispering into ears or conversing at the top of voices. Then she saw Jende by the door, chatting with someone, probably one of Winston's friends, whom he'd met during the month he lived with Winston when he first came to America. She was trying to decide whether to join Jende or order a glass of soda on Winston's tab when a young white woman with curly dark hair appeared in front of her, a cocktail glass in hand, smiling as if she'd just seen something incredibly special.
"Oh, my God," the young woman said. "You must be Nenny."
Nenny nodded, broadening her smile.
"I'm Jenny, Winston's girlfriend."
"Winston's girlfriend?"
"So glad to finally meet you," Jenny said,
giving Nenny a hug.
"I am glad to meet you too,"
Nenny said, struggling to enunciate and scream above the hip-hop music blasting into her ears from every direction.
"Are you having a good time?"
Jenny shouted, moving closer to her.
"Would you like a drink?"
Nenny shook her head.
"I'm so glad we finally get to meet,"
Jenny shouted again.
"I've heard so much about you."
"Thank you. I am happy to meet you too. I've been telling Winston that we need to hang out, all 4 of us. But it's just so tough with everyone's work schedules. But we've got to. Is Jende here?"
Nenny nodded and smiled, still thinking, "Winston's girlfriend?"
"How do you like New York? Winston tells me you've been here for only 2 years.
"I love it very much. I am very happy to be here.
I'd love to go to Cameroon,"
Jenny said, smiling and looking upward dreamingly.
"Winston doesn't seem too eager to visit anytime soon, but I'm pushing for us to go sometime next year."
Nani looked at Jenny, grinning and sipping her cocktail, and couldn't decide whether to laugh or feel sorry for her. What was she thinking? Winston was never going to marry a white woman. He didn't even bother introducing the ones he slept with to his family, because he changed them the way someone changes underwear. All Nani and Jende knew right now was that he was playing one of the other associates at the firm. Apparently, this was her. The poor thing. The way her eyes lit up every time she said his name. She looked no older than 26, but not too young to have noticed that successful Cameroonian men like Winston hardly ever married non-Cameroonian women. They enjoyed every type for as long as they could. White, Filipino, Mexican, Iranian, Chinese, any woman of any color who availed herself, out of infatuation or undeniable love or mere curiosity. But when the time came to choose a wife, how many of them married one of those women? Too few. And Winston would never be one of those few. If he couldn't find a good Bakweri girl, he would marry one from another tribe in the southwest or northwest regions. But definitely not from the Bangwa tribe, since his mother hated Bangwas, for whatever reason. He would marry his kind because a man like him needed a woman who understood his heart, shared his values and interests, knew how to give him the things he needed, accepted that his children must be raised in the same manner in which his parents had raised him, and only a woman from his homeland could do that.
"There you are,"
someone said from behind. Nenny turned around to see another young woman with a cocktail glass in hand, probably Jenny's friend. Jenny turned around too, hugged the other woman, and introduced Nenny as Winston's cousin who just came from Africa. Just came from Africa? Nenny thought. She didn't just come from Africa. She considered correcting Jenny, but not knowing if it would be polite to do so, instead forced out a smile at Jenny's friend, who nodded, but otherwise barely acknowledged her presence. The friend began telling Jenny a story, and the women veered into another conversation, leaving Nenny a smiling spectator to their camaraderie. After 10 minutes, unsure of what to do besides continue trying to prove to herself that she could be at ease in a bar, she hurriedly excused herself. The two women hardly paused to say goodbye. She pushed through the crowd, which seemed to have tripled since she and Jende arrived, and inadvertently hit a young man's drink with her elbow. The drink did not spill, but the young man gave her a look that she was certain meant, "What the hell are you doing here, you stupid African woman?" Jende was standing alone where she'd last seen him, sipping a drink through a straw and slowly moving to the hip-hop music in his bright yellow Madiba shirt.
"I'm ready to go," she said in his ear.
"Why?" he said. "I was wondering where you were. Did you have anything to drink?"
"I don't want a drink."
"Is it your nausea? Won't some Coca-Cola help?"
"Did I complain to you about my nausea? Let's go."
"Ah, Nenny, just 30 more minutes. I've only had 2 seconds on the beach."
"Then stay. I'm leaving." "You won't even talk to Winston and wish him happy birthday?"
"I'll call him tomorrow."
Outside on 58th Street, the air was cool and refreshing. The noise level bearable except for 2 ambulances rushing to Roosevelt Hospital a block away. Nenny turned her face away from the hospital in an attempt to block out the memory of what had happened there a year ago. The afternoon she had rushed with her friend Betty to labor and delivery because Betty was cramping heavily. Betty had received an emergency C-section only for the baby to come out stillborn.
"Let's go sit at Columbus Circle for a little bit,"
Jende said, and she quickly agreed, banishing from her mind the image of the lifeless newborn she wished she hadn't seen. Jende began talking about how great a time he'd had talking to one of Winston's friends, but she was barely listening. She was noticing something for the first time. She was realizing that most people on the street were walking with someone who looked like them. On both sides of the street, going east and west, she saw people walking with their kind. A white man holding hands with a white woman. A black teenager giggling with other black or Latino teenagers. A white mother pushing a stroller alongside another white mother. A black woman chatting with a black woman. She saw a quartet of Asian men in tuxedos, and a group of friends who had different skin colors but were dressed in similar elegant chic styles. Most people were sticking to their own kind. Even in New York City, even in a place of many nations and cultures, men and women, young and old, rich and poor, preferred their kind when it came to those they kept closest. And why shouldn't they? It was far easier to do so than to spend one's limited energy trying to blend into a world one was never meant to be a part of. That was what made New York so wonderful. It had a world for everyone. She had her world in Harlem, and never again would she try to wriggle her way into a world in Midtown. Not even for just an hour. When they got to Columbus Circle, she called Fatou, who told her that Leomi was fine. They could stay out for however long they wanted. So they sat beneath the statue of Christopher Columbus, side by side, hand in hand, surrounded by skateboarders and young lovers and homeless people, looking north as cars came around the circle and went up Central Park West. The spring air was crisper than she would have wished, but not crisp enough to send her rushing into the subway. And even if it had been, she would have stayed in the circle, because it wasn't every night she got a chance to enjoy the sounds of the city and its millions of lights blinking around her, reminding her that she was still living in her dream. Boubacar had assured them that they could be in the country for many years. which meant they could be in the city for many years. A massive smile involuntarily appeared on her face at the thought, and she moved closer to Jende and leaned against him. "This is the best place in the whole city," he said to her. She did not ask why he thought so, because she knew why. In his first days in America, it was here he came every night to take in the city. It was here he often sat to call her when he got so lonely and homesick that the only balm that worked was the sound of her voice. During those calls, he would ask her how Leomi was doing, what she was wearing, what her plans for the weekend were, and she would tell him everything, leaving him even more wistful for the beauty of her smile, the hearth in his mother's kitchen, the light breeze at Down Beach, the tightness of Leomi's hugs, the coarse jokes and laughter of his friends as they drank Guinness at a drinking spot, leaving him craving everything he wished he hadn't left behind. During those times, he told her, he often wondered if leaving home in search of something as fleeting as fortune was ever worthwhile. "You know what I'm realizing now," he said to her.
"What?"
she asked, looking at him adoringly.
"We are sitting in the center of the world,"
she laughed.
"You're so funny."
"No, think about it," he said. "Columbus Circle is the center of Manhattan. Manhattan is the center of New York. New York is the center of America. And America is the center of the world. So, we are sitting in the center of the world, right?"
Chapter 15. On the way to the golf course in Westchester, Clark complained about his stiff neck, grumbled about Phil inviting a bunch of other people to join them, and thus making it hard for him to pull out, griped about spending his afternoon doing an activity he didn't care for when he could be in the office. Jende listened and nodded, as always, agreeing with everything he said.
"Golf's not my thing," Clark said.
"A lot of people like to pretend it's their thing, but I couldn't care less about going today. If it wasn't for a chance to spend time with the guys outside of work."
"It looks like a very hard game, sir."
"It really isn't. You should try it sometime."
"I will, sir,"
Jende said, though he had no idea why or where he would ever go to golf. Halfway to the course in Rye, Clark's mother called to check on him, and he put her on speakerphone, saying he didn't want to stiffen his neck any further. His mother thanked him for the anniversary gift and was about to tell him a funny story about bumping into an old neighbor from Evanston when another call came in. Clark told her he had to go and promised he would call her back after taking the incoming call from his boss.
"You're heading to join Phil and the others?"
Tom asked. His voice over the speaker sounded far less powerful than Jende had expected the voice of a CEO to sound. It was genial, but lacked the authority that Clark's possessed.
"Yeah, you're coming, right?"
"No, can't make it. Michelle's not feeling too well."
"Sorry to hear."
"How's Cindy?"
Tom said after a few seconds.
"She looked great on Thursday."
"Yeah, she knows how to take care of herself."
"Heard a couple of guys at the bar wondering whose trophy she was." Clark chuckled.
"I'll take whatever compliments I can get these days," he said.
Jende cleared his throat, not because it needed clearing, but because he could tell Tom wanted to say something important, and he wanted to alert Clark of his presence so Clark could switch his phone off speaker mode. He knew enough about Lehman as it was and didn't care to hear anything else, especially something he would be tempted to tell Leah, since she'd been hounding him for details about Clark's conversations so she could know how bad things really were. He always told her he knew nothing, but the woman didn't know how to give up.
"So,"
Tom said, finally ready to get to his point,
"I imagine you know why I'm calling."
"I'm guessing you spoke to Donald," Clark said.
"I was hoping to—"
"You have no right to go to a board member behind my back, Clark."
"It wasn't my intention. I bumped into him rushing to get to my son's hockey game,
quickly told him that I've been trying to get a meeting with you to talk about...
About what?
Tom said, his voice rising.
About your bullshit about coming clean? Changing strategy? What do you think we're doing here, playing patty cake?
I think we need to rethink our long-term strategy, Tom, Clark said, raising his voice too.
I've been saying it, and I'll keep on saying it.
We're sitting here acting as if we're dealing with forces out of our control when we're not. It's merely a matter of looking at other angles, considering other models. Back in August, I came to you when it was crystal clear that ABS performance was never going to really pick up, and the damage was quickly spreading past subprime to Alt-A. Remember we had that talk and I suggested we change course?
What's your point?
When you and Danny laughed off the Chinese, I pushed for us to take whatever infusion they were throwing at us, get us out of this mess as soon as...
And tell the world we're drowning? Sure. Let's become laughing stocks.
BS didn't want to become a laughing stock.
We're not BS. We're Lehman. And if you don't know that, if you don't know that we're the brothers and that we always win, then I really can't help you, Clark. If you don't believe in what we're doing here, then you've been wasting your time for the past 22 years.
Jende heard Clark scoff and imagined he was shaking his head as well.
Why are you scoffing? Tom asked.
All I'm trying to say is that we need to change our approach a bit. Maybe get more aggressive on raising capital. Everyone else on the street's been running around raising capital, and we're sitting here deceiving shareholders that we're strongly capitalized. If we could so much as even,
you will not circumvent me and talk to a board member again. Do you understand?
Clark exhaled deeply, but did not respond.
Do we have an agreement?
Clark ignored the question.
As for coming clean, how long do you think before the world finds out about the leverage ratio? Clark said. Are you going to sit in front of Congress and say you knew nothing about Repo 105? 'Cause there's just how long we can sustain this, and at some point we're gonna have to...
So you think airing our dirty laundry is what's going to get us back in the right direction? You think we should listen to you because you decided to grow a damn conscience?
This has got nothing to do with a conscience.
You know I love the game. You know I love winning as much as the next guy, and I'm all for doing what we need to do to win. But there's a level where we've got to admit that we've gone too far. And if we keep on going at this rate...
Really?
Tom said derisively.
How far back should we go so we're not too far ahead of the curve?
Back to the 70s?
Why don't we all jump into a 75 Buick while everyone is passing us by in 08 models?
That's what you're asking for, right? Because we've become so ruthless, let's try and be sweet and nice.
I'm not...
I really can't help you, you know?
Tom said, almost sympathetically.
Whatever crisis you're going through, I can't do anything to help you. And frankly, this isn't the best time to be dealing with it.
I'm simply saying that we should show we stand for something better than everyone else, Tom.
That could be our salvation.
If we quit pulling the tricks, place the blame on someone else, if we must, auditors, rogue accountants, whoever, give ourselves a chance to get straight before it gets worse. Because right now, we're pulling these tricks and the SEC's playing dumb, but you know as well as I do that if this shit falls apart and the chaos starts spreading, they're going to throw us out for the public to crucify by claiming they didn't know a damn thing. And we all know it's a lie.
And you think the board's going to love your suggestion?
Donald wasn't exactly opposed.
What gives you that idea? Donald thought you'd gone crazy.
What's crazy is thinking we're going to survive doing business this way,
Clark shouted, apparently unaware of how much his voice had risen.
We've made a ton of mistakes already. We're in this shit because we haven't shown great foresight. We've got to think far beyond Lehman. We've got to think about the next generation taking over the street after we're gone. About how they're going to judge us. About how history's going to judge us.
Another phone rang wherever Tom was. He picked it up, spoke softly to someone he referred to as Honey, and assured the person that he would be there. No way in the world was he going to miss it.
I'd
rather not lose you right now, he said to Clark after hanging up, his voice as soft as if he were still speaking to the other person.
We've survived highs and lows together for 18 years, and I know, I'm absolutely certain we'll survive this one too. But if you think this is all too much for you, then I'll sadly accept your resignation.
I'm not going anywhere, Clark said. There's a battle going on, and I intend to keep fighting for Lehman.
Good.
Yes, good.
So why don't you get back to work and fight the way I've decided is best? And if someday I'm proven wrong, you can look back at this moment and be damn proud of yourself.
Chapter 16. He had been waiting on the curb for 35 minutes when Vince finally came out of his apartment building and hopped into the back seat, cup of coffee in one hand.
Jende, my man, Vince said, patting him on the shoulder.
Good morning, Vince.
So sorry for making you wait. I wish I had a good excuse.
It's no problem.
I will try to drive fast, so we are not late for your appointment. No, take your time. I'm never eager to be on time for a dental appointment. I wouldn't even be going all the way to Long Island if my mom didn't insist Dr. Mariano is the world's best dentist.
It's good to have a dentist, Jende said, imagining how good it would feel to have someone else clean his teeth.
He made a right turn onto Broadway and drove from the 90s to the 50s, and then from west to east onto I-495.
Would you like me to turn on the radio? He asked Vince.
No, I'm good,
Vince said distractedly. He was fidgeting and looking around the car.
I think I left my phone at home, he said.
I can go back, Jende said.
No, it's fine.
It is no problem for me, Vince.
No, it's all good,
Vince said, leaning back in his seat and taking a sip of his coffee.
It'll be a good exercise in disconnecting from the world. Besides, I get to talk to you uninterrupted and continue trying to unindoctrinate you on all the lies you've been fed about America.
Jende laughed.
There is nothing you can say, Vince. Nothing you or any man can say to me to make me stop believing that America is the greatest country in the world. And Barack Obama will win the election and become one of the greatest presidents in the history of America.
That's cool.
I'm not gonna argue too hard with that.
But what if I tell you that America killed the African revolutionary Patrice Lumumba in their effort to stop the spread of communism and tighten their grip around the world?
Ah, Lumumba. I used to have a t-shirt with his face back in Limbe. Whenever I wore it, people stopped me on the street to look at his face and say, oh, what a great man.
So what if I tell you America killed that great man?
I will say I am sorry for what happened to him, but I don't know the whole story.
I'm telling you the whole story,
Jende chuckled.
You are so funny, Vince, he said. I like how you want to help me see things another way, but maybe the way I see America is good for me.
That's exactly the problem. People don't want to open their eyes and see the truth because the illusion suits them. As long as they're fed whatever lies they want to hear, they're happy, because the truth means nothing to them. Look at my parents. They're struggling under the weight of so many pointless pressures. But if they could ever free themselves from this self-inflicted oppression, they would find genuine happiness. Instead, they continue to go down a path of achievements and accomplishments and material success and shit that means nothing because that's what America's all about. And now they're trapped. And they don't get it.
Your parents are good people, Vince.
In their own way, sure. Your father works so hard. Sometimes he looks so tired, I feel bad for him. But it's what we do for our children. I don't doubt his sacrifices.
Even if you don't like America too much, I think you should still thank God that you have a mother and father who give you a good life. And now you can go to law school and become a lawyer and give your children a good life too.
Become a lawyer? Who said anything about me becoming a lawyer?
Zhende did not respond. He thought he was mistaken. Maybe law school wasn't only for people who wanted to become lawyers.
This is my last semester at law school,
Vin said.
I won't be returning in the fall.
You're not going to finish school?
I'm moving to India.
You are moving to India?
I'd rather you don't tell my parents any of this just yet.
No, I would never.
I'm only telling you this because I enjoy talking to you. And maybe as a parent you can advise me on how I can tell my parents?
Zhende nodded and for a brief stretch of time said nothing. The highway was mostly empty and quiet, except for the siren of an ambulance far in the distance. On the side of the westbound lane, billboards displayed advertisements for hotels and hospitals with pictures of good-looking people, the people at the hospitals looking as healthy and happy as the ones at the hotels.
I just do not know what to say, Vince, Zhende finally said. I only think that you should please finish school and become a lawyer. Then maybe you could visit India for vacation.
I don't want to be a lawyer. I've never wanted to be a lawyer.
But why?
A lot of lawyers are miserable, Vince said. I don't want to be miserable.
My cousin is a lawyer.
Is he happy?
Sometimes he's happy, sometimes he's not. Is there anybody who is happy all the time? A man can be unhappy doing any kind of work.
Sure.
Then why can you not just think you will be a happy man no matter what kind of work you do?
I can't even stand law school right now. I look at my classmates and I feel terrible. Just saddens me to see them spending all those precious hours of their lives being indoctrinated with lies so they can go into the world and perpetuate the lies. They don't know they're about to become pieces of a ruthless machine that specializes in ripping out the innards of innocence. The whole system is a joke. People going around living meaningless lives because it's what they've been conditioned to think is good for them. Walking around completely mindless of the fact that they're living in a society ruled by a cold-blooded cabal. How long are we going to remain in this bondage? I mean, really, how long?
Zhende shook his head.
Vince's rant made no sense to him.
But from the manner in which the young man's voice was rising and his tone hardening, he could tell Vince truly hated law school and anything to do with lawyers. And he could tell this wasn't even about law school or lawyers or America. It was more about Vince wanting to leave his world and everything his parents wanted for him. Vince wanting to become a whole new person.
I am so sorry, Vince, he said.
You don't have to be sorry for me. I'm living my truth.
No, I am sorry. I am not sorry for you. I am just sorry for how you feel.
Vince chuckled.
I am not going to lie to you, Zhende said. If my son tells me that he is going to leave law school and move to India, I swear I will bring out my molongo and whip his buttocks well.
What's a molongo?
The stick our parents use to beat us back home when we behave like bad children. I have one for my son, but he is lucky. I cannot use it here. I don't want any trouble whatsoever.
Vince chuckled again.
I can't do anything besides shout at him.
And in your country, you'd beat him even when he's my age?
No, man, Zhende said, laughing. I was just joking with you there. Our parents stop whipping our buttocks when we are, like, 19.
19?
Or 20 sometimes. But the thing I am trying to say is that if your father and mother are angry when you tell them this news, I hope you will understand.
Vince did not respond, and for a minute he was quiet, staring out the window. I know it won't be easy for them to understand, he said. Considering I'm nothing like them. Then again, all the hundreds of thousands of dollars they spent at Dalton and summer camps in NYU and Columbia,
was for me to be what they want me to be. So my mom can tell her friends about her son's new job as a clerk with Judge So-and-so. Total bullshit.
Oh, Vince, Jende said. Someday when you have children, you will not talk like this.
It amazes me you're so different. And yet you're so like my parents in many ways.
Maybe that's why me and your father get along very well. In fact, I think that if you could just take it easy on your father, maybe you will see him from another angle and see that he is a very nice man.
Yeah, well, maybe someday I'll see this super niceness that you see, Vince said. We've never been a close family, so I've never been able to see him as much more than an absent provider who's going through the motions for the sake of his family.
It's not easy, Jende said, shaking his head as he turned onto Elm Street, where the dentist's office was located.
Who is it not easy for?
For you? For your father? For every child? Every parent? For everybody? It's just not easy, this life here in this world.
No,
Vince said.
That's why our only choice is to embrace suffering and surrender to the truth.
Embrace suffering, Jende laughed. You are talking some funny things, yeah?
Well, we can talk about what that means on the way back, Vince said, smiling and sitting up as Jende moved toward a parking spot. But please, whatever we discussed about law school in India, that's just between me and you for now.
Jende nodded, turned around, and extended his hand, which Vince shook before exiting the car. When Vince returned to the car an hour later, his mouth was heavy from the anesthesia that had been used to numb him before his wisdom tooth extraction, and he could barely talk. He fell asleep within minutes, his right hand holding the ice pack soothing his slightly swollen face. At intervals, Jende looked through the rearview mirror at Vince's face, and every time he imagined Leomi in about 18 years. He knew he would never permit Leomi to throw away a chance at a successful career and a good life to go walking around India, talking about truth and suffering. And yet he couldn't fully denounce what Vince was doing. Looking at the young man sleeping, he felt proud of him, even as he worried for him.
Chapter 17. The city that summer overflowed with the hot and thirsty, panting on subway platforms, battling the sun with wide hats and light clothes, rushing to scaffoldings for shade, dashing into department stores not for the sales advertised on windows, but for the AC. Those unable to escape to beaches and countrysides congregated in places where the humidity could briefly be forgotten. World music concerts with musicians from far-flung lands like Kazakhstan and Burkina Faso. Rooftop revelries where everyone seemed absolutely certain of their good looks and sophistication. Street fairs with too much grilled chicken and not enough moving air. Sunset cruises with last-minute tickets and mediocre cocktails. There was much to do in the city, and yet the desperation remained among many to be out of it. To be in a place where the mission was pleasure and not endurance. To sit where the air moved without burden and the water went on for thousands of miles. A place like the villages of the Hamptons. Jende could take a paid vacation in the first 2 weeks of August, Clark informed him as they drove down Lexington on a mid-June morning. The family would be spending late July and pretty much all of August in Southampton, Cindy and the boys mostly, as well as random days in early July, so it should be an overall light summer of work.
I am very grateful, sir,
Jende said without a change in his countenance, though inwardly he was grinning wider than the Great Rift Valley. It would be the first time in America he'd been paid to do nothing, though he knew he wasn't going to sit around idle for 2 weeks. He was going to call the livery cab company he used to work for and get shifts so he could add to the funds he and Nanny were saving for his deportation case.
You should ask Cindy if she needs a housekeeper for that last week in July and the first 3 weeks in August when Anna takes her vacation, Clark added minutes later. She usually gets someone from the agency. Maybe your wife would like to do it and make some extra money?
Oh, yes, sir. My wife, she would,
We would be very grateful, sir.
Cindy did need someone, and Nanny needed a break from the oft-gloomy task of feeding and bathing incapacitated senior citizens. Though it was the prospect of earning more money in 4 weeks than she made in 3 months that prompted her and Jende to discuss the offer for only 5 minutes before agreeing that she would skip the second summer semester, since her student visa allowed her to, and go to Southampton. She called Cindy Edwards that evening, after Jende had coached her on what to say, what not to say, how to say the right things well, introduced herself, and said she would like the job. Cindy offered her the job, though not before telling her what was involved, maintaining a spotless 5-bedroom house, grocery shopping for specific items that must be gotten right, daily laundry, cooking specific recipes, serving guests in a dignified manner, babysitting a 10-year-old as needed, 12-hour workdays with lots of downtime.
I will do it all very well, madam, Nanny said, holding the phone tightly against her ear.
I trust you will. Jende's a hard worker, and I imagine you're no different. Only, madame, it's just one more thing, she said.
What's that?
I'm 4 months pregnant, madame. It's not going to be a problem for me, but...
Then it won't be a problem for me either, Cindy said, ending the matter,
and then telling Nanny that in the last week of June she would need to take the Long Island Railroad with Anna to the Hamptons so she could get acquainted with Cindy's needs and expectations.
Make sure you only do what they say you do, and exactly the way they say you do it,
Jende said to Nanny just before she descended the steps into the subway to travel to the Hamptons to begin her 4-week stint.
No more, no less.
Ah, you too, she said, laughing. What do you think I'm going to do over there?
It's not a laughing matter, Nanny. Just do your work well.
That's all I'm saying. Don't do or say anything that doesn't concern you. These people are our bread and tea.
Don't worry, she said,
still laughing at his serious demeanor, which she found both cute and unnecessary.
I won't disgrace you. It's not like I've never been around rich people.
Which was true. Her family used to be rich in the 80s and early 90s. Back then her father was a customs officer at the seaport in Douala. And, thanks to all the gratuities, not bribes, her father swore he never once got his palms greased, that he and his colleagues took from merchants bringing goods into the country, he was able to multiply his annual government salary by 10 and ensure that his family lacked no good thing. They lived in a brick house with tiled outer walls and floors and running water. They owned electrical appliances and a working telephone, and her father even owned a car, a dilapidated blue 1970s Peugeot, but still a car and thus a symbol of prosperity in Limbe. They were the first family in their Down Beach neighborhood to own a TV set. Nanny still remembered those early days of television in the late 80s. When CRTV broadcasted only from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the evening. By 5:45 every evening, the neighborhood children would be in their living room, sitting on the floor, waiting for tele to begin. When the TV static, which the children called rice, slowly disappeared to reveal the Cameroonian flag, the children would giggle with delight, and the adults, packed on the sofa and chairs all around the living room, would tell them to be quiet. Television was on. No one was allowed to make noise when television was on. Children were supposed to watch the news in silence, while the adults discussed the atrocities in South Africa every time a picture of Nelson Mandela came up, wondering when those bad white people were going to set that good man free. Children were supposed to watch documentaries in silence, watch fast-talking cartoons, which they called Poku Poku, in silence. They had to be quiet during whatever British or French or American series CRTV was broadcasting, soap operas and sitcoms, which they barely understood, but nonetheless giggled at whenever kissing scenes came on and groaned whenever someone was punched. The only time children were allowed to talk was when a music video came on. Then they were encouraged by the adults to stand up and dance to Ndedia Yangu or Charlotte Mbango or Tom Yoms. And every time, they would stand up and bust out their best Makossa moves, twirling tiny buttocks and moving clenched fists from right to left with all their might, smiling to no end. To be able to see their favorite musician singing in a black box, what a privilege. Nanny smiled at the memories as she sat in the train. She was a teenager back then, but as a middle child, she wasn't allowed to touch the TV. Turning it on and off were rights reserved for her father and oldest brother. Nowadays, even three-year-olds in Limbe could turn a TV on and off. Every third house in town had CNN, though funnily, her parents' house didn't. Her father had stopped working at the seaport in 93, forced out by a Bamileke boss who wanted his tribesmen to take Neni's father's job. With no warning, he had been transferred to a far less lucrative position at the Treasury Department in Limbe. And 6 months after that, his widowed sister had died, leaving behind three children he had no choice but to take in and raise alongside his five. With the loss of his prestigious job came the loss of some of the power and respect he'd had as a rich man. Folks still greeted him with both hands, but many stopped coming to his house to visit, knowing that upon leaving they wouldn't receive 5 or 10,000 CFA francs to pay taxi. These days he was retired, living on a meager pension, without much to his name besides an ancient blue Peugeot in the garage of his brick house. Chapter 18. The Edward Summer House wasn't made of bricks, but it didn't need to be. All of the brick houses of Newtown Limbe put together couldn't compete with one of its rooms. When Nenni had first gone there with Anna to learn her duties, she had tried not to show Anna how awed she was, but Anna must have seen it on her face. Her eyes couldn't stop roving from the moment they stepped out of the cab in front of the two-story, warm, gray stone and wood shingled house with meticulously manicured boxwood spheres on both sides of the four-columned portico. It wasn't only the size that astounded her. Why did they need such a big house for only a few months a year? Why five bedrooms when there were only two children? Didn't they understand that no matter how much money a person had, they could sleep on only one bed at a time? But also the profuse elegance. Even on her third day there, she was still flabbergasted by the sumptuousness of her surroundings, especially the living room, with its all-white decor and large windows as if to never lose a view of the sky. She was astonished by its spotlessness, which Anna had told her was because Cindy hated dirt even more than she hated cheap things. Its plush white carpets and wool rugs, which she almost feared stepping on, and its black chandelier and glass accents, so delicate-looking she dusted with tenderness, worried she would leave a mark. The afternoon she arrived, Vince had given her a hug and told her to make herself comfortable, though she couldn't see how she could possibly do so if she was in a constant state of unease about ruining something. She spent all evening of that first day in the kitchen with Mighty, too circumspect to go anywhere besides her bedroom after Vince left for the city to meditate at Unity. Jende wasn't exaggerating. And Cindy went out to dinner with friends. Even in those first hours in Southampton, she could tell Mighty would be her only true source of joy there. He reminded her of Leomi, thanks to his abundant eyelashes, and the way he never seemed to lack something to laugh or smile about.
"Do you like living in Harlem?"
he asked her while she was making his dinner, surprising her with his forwardness, a characteristic untypical of children from Limbe. "It's nice," she said.
"Jende says he doesn't like it too much."
"He said that?" Nenni said, turning from the stove.
"Why would he say that?" "Because he's honest,"
Mighty said with a laugh.
"And honesty's the best policy, right?"
Even when she wished he wasn't so inquisitive, she couldn't deny that he was a token of how normal rich children could be. During their first days together, he amused her with questions about African lions and leopards and what kind of animals she had seen roaming around Limbe, questions she was sure he'd already asked Jende at least a dozen times, but which delighted her so much that she made up tales about monkeys stealing her lunch when she was a schoolgirl and a classmate who used to come to school riding on an elephant. "I don't believe it," Mighty would say to such stories, and Nenni would make up an even more incredible one. Babysitting him was by far the most enjoyable part of her job, and the part she was certain she impressed Cindy the most in executing. Every time Cindy walked into a room to see her and Mighty laughing or playing, Nani could sense Cindy's approval because nothing appeared to matter to the Madame more than the happiness of her children, their nonstop possession of every good thing life had to offer. If Mighty was laughing and Vince was smiling, there couldn't be a happier woman on earth than Cindy Edwards. This desire for their happiness, constantly asking if they needed something, always reminding Nani to make their meals and snacks just the way they liked them, giving Mighty three kisses every time either of them left the house, was followed closely only by her obvious need for a sense of belonging, an utterly desperate need she could never seem to quench. It was a longing that confounded Nani, because on the day they met, Cindy Edwards appeared to be a woman with no desperate needs. From the moment they shook hands in the portico until Cindy left for her dinner, the Madame was enveloped in an air of superiority, standing tall and keeping her shoulders back as she walked in long strides, slowly enunciating every word when she spoke, as if she had the right to take as much of the listener's time as she wished. She pointed with slender, manicured fingers bearing a sole emerald ring, nodding like an omnipotent empress as she took Nani around the house to give her polite but specific instructions on what she must do every morning and how she must do it, as she told her things that Anna might have said but which she needed to reiterate. Things like what she couldn't stand in a housekeeper, dishonesty, poor communication, and not acting with poise when company was around. And yet, despite this portrait of a self-assured woman, Cindy seemed to have a near obsession with being where everyone was and doing what everyone was doing. Within 4 days, Nani noticed that she was on the phone with a friend at least once a day, wondering if the friend had gotten an invitation to so-and-so's cocktail party or this and that's dinner party or that upcoming gala or wedding. On the few occasions when her friends apparently told her they'd gotten their invites and she hadn't gotten hers, she seemed to be in physical pain. Her deep sighs and suddenly slumped shoulders and sad voice revealing to Nani that despite the fact that she was telling her friends that it was okay, she wasn't okay because she was probably wondering why she hadn't been invited, what she'd done to not be invited if her social status was intact. This desperation to always be a part of something, always maintain a sense of specialness thanks to the action of others, baffled Nani. But she didn't call Jende to talk about it because she knew he would say what he always said whenever she said she couldn't understand why people cared about stupid things like the approval of others. Different things are important to different people. 5 days after her arrival, though, she called him to talk about Cindy, terrified.
"I think Mrs. Edwards is very sick," she whispered from her room in the basement.
"What's wrong?" he asked.
There was no one else in the house, and Mrs. Edwards looked sick, she told him.
"What kind of sick, Nani? Fever, headache, stomachache?"
"No, no, not that kind of sick," she whispered again.
Where was everybody, he wanted to know. Mr. Edwards was in the city, and Mighty and Vince were at the beach, she informed him. What did it matter where they were, she asked in frustration after replying to the question.
Mrs. Edwards did not look well, and she was afraid because she didn't know what to do.
The Madame looked like she was very sick, but maybe she wasn't sick. She needed advice from her husband, not one question after another.
"But you are saying 50 different things," he said. "Say something that makes sense."
Mrs. Edwards had told her she was going into her bedroom for a nap and asked that she not be disturbed. Nani had stayed in the basement doing laundry before remembering that the sheets in the guest bedroom needed to be laundered. She had opened the door to the second floor guest room without knocking, assuming Mrs. Edwards was asleep in the master bedroom on the first floor. When she entered, she had seen the frightful sight. The always composed and elegant Madame splayed against the headboard of the bed, hair strands lying on her sweaty face, her hands limp on her sides, her mouth half open with saliva halfway down her chin.
"I'm afraid," she said to him, panicked and near tears. "She was fine this morning.
She told me 1 hour ago that she was going to nap, and then I go to the guest bedroom and see this.
Does she look dead? Jende asked.
No, I saw her breathing, she whispered. Oh, Papa God, what should I do?
Jende was silent for a moment.
Don't do anything, he told his wife. Just pretend you didn't see anything. If something happens to her, you can say you did not know. You can say you never entered the room.
But what if something is wrong and I am supposed to do something?
Neni, listen to me,
her husband commanded.
Let her husband and her sons find her and decide what to do. Do not touch her, you hear me? Don't even go back to the room. Do not involve yourself in their business, I am begging you.
I have to do...
You don't have to do anything.
She hung up and called her friend Betty. Betty was in her 7th year of nursing school. She would know what to do.
I think it's drugs, oh.
Betty screeched above the sound of her children screaming in the background.
Only drugs can make you look like that.
Betty, please stop joking. I'm talking about something serious, which...
Who said I'm joking? I'm telling you that it's drugs.
No, not Mrs. Edwards.
Why are you arguing with me? Rich people like them. They like drugs.
Not Mrs. Edwards. She's not that kind of person, Betty. I swear to you.
Where do you know her from? Because she wears nice clothes. You think...
What would she do drugs for?
Nanny, please. If you don't want to believe me, then let me get off the phone.
Oh, Papa God,
Nanny cried, slapping her thigh as the phone beeped and displayed an incoming call from Jende. She ignored his call, knowing what he wanted to reiterate.
Listen to me,
Betty said.
Listen. Go wake her up. Shake her only softly, okay?
And what if she doesn't wake up?
You move that thing one more time,
Betty shouted away from the receiver.
I'll come over there and cause you some serious injuries.
Betty, I don't know.
Hold on,
Betty said. And for almost a minute, Nanny heard nothing but the sound of a toddler screaming.
You don't teach these children how to obey. Tomorrow they'll start behaving like American children,
Betty said when she returned to the phone.
You think I should wake her up?
Yes, go wake her up.
Chai. Man no die rotten.
You've used your pretty legs to walk right into trouble.
Nanny laughed. The kind of mirthless laugh her mother used to emit when life was so strange only a laugh could give one the strength to face it.
If she's dead,
Betty added,
call her husband, not the police.
Okay, let me go.
And Nanny,
Betty said right before she hung up.
Please, don't tell the police you called me first. I'm begging. Don't even mention my name for any reason whatsoever. I'm afraid of police people.
Nanny hung up and ran back upstairs, her grip tight around her cell phone. Cindy was sleeping in the same position. For a minute, Nanny stood next to the bed, staring at the prescription pill bottle next to the empty glass and half-empty bottle of red wine on the nightstand, before moving closer.
Mrs. Edwards,
she whispered, nudging Cindy in the arm. Jende would kill her for this, but she couldn't leave the woman alone in this state. Cindy did not respond. Nanny put her cell phone in the pocket of her kaba, leaned closer, and spoke directly into Cindy's ear.
Mrs. Edwards.
Immediately, Cindy closed her mouth and began smacking her lips.
Mrs. Edwards, are you okay?
Cindy opened her eyes slightly.
What do you want?
She asked in a husky slur.
Nothing, madame. I just wanted to make sure you're all right.
Cindy sat up, brushed off the hair lying on her face, wiped her chin. She opened her eyes fully and looked at Nanny.
What time is it?
Nanny took out her cell phone and looked at the time.
5 o'clock, madame.
Shit,
Cindy said, turning her legs around to get out of the bed. She staggered with her first step, and Nanny quickly caught her by the arm.
It's okay,
Cindy said, pulling away.
I'm okay.
Still brushing hair off her face, she sat on the armchair next to the closet and asked for a glass of cold water, which Nanny hastily ran off to get even before she was done asking. When she finished drinking, Cindy asked for a second glass of water and a plate of salad, plain lettuce with oil and vinegar, which Nanny brought on a tray. Carefully, Nanny lifted Cindy's legs and placed them on a footstool so the tray could balance with ease on her lap.
"Would you like me to run a bath for you, madame?"
Nanny asked. Cindy nodded. Nanny went into the bathroom, scrubbed her hands, and turned on the water in the bathtub. She poured in 10 drops of bubble bath, knelt by the tub, her growing belly against its cold skin, and stirred the water in the gentle, circular manner that Anna had taught her. When the tub was full, she came out and took Cindy's tray.
"Clark won't be coming tonight anymore,"
Cindy said as Nanny was about to exit the bedroom.
"Vince is leaving after he and Mighty get back. He's spending the next couple of days with a friend on Martha's Vineyard. You can serve Mighty his dinner whenever he wants."
"Yes, madame,"
Nanny said and hurried downstairs. Around 7 o'clock, she heard the Jaguar's engine in the driveway, Cindy leaving for one social engagement or another. Chapter 19. She stood at the door, knocking lightly and insistently, determined to wake her up.
"What is it?"
she heard Cindy groan.
"It's me, madame,"
Nanny replied.
"Yes? I was just wondering, madame, about your breakfast. If you would like me to bring it in there or set it out for you by the pool." "What time is it?"
11 o'clock, madame."
"By the pool,"
she said after a pause.
"Set it in an hour."
When Cindy came out of the bedroom just before noon, after showering and putting on a purple-striped halter-top dress, Nanny was at the kitchen counter slicing up pineapples.
"Almost ready, madame,"
she said.
"Good morning."
Cindy nodded and went to the table by the pool. Through the window, Nanny could see her staring at the pool water, which was blue and still, except for a lone leaf causing frail ripples at the center. Nanny picked up the tray and hurried outside.
"I'm sorry to keep you waiting, madame,"
she said, placing the tray on the table.
"Would you like anything else?" "Where's Mighty?"
"He went to the water, madame, with the neighbor and the neighbor's son. He said it would be okay with you. I gave him a sandwich and a banana."
Cindy picked up a glass pitcher to pour milk into her coffee. Nanny turned around and started walking back to the kitchen.
"Nanny?"
Cindy called, just as Nanny was about to re-enter the house.
"Madame, pull up a seat and sit right here."
Nanny looked at Cindy puzzled, but she returned and obeyed. For the next minute, Cindy took little bites of her egg white omelet, her sliced pineapples, and her blueberries. Nanny sat across from her and stared at the concrete.
"Thank you for helping me yesterday,"
Cindy began, setting her coffee mug down and dabbing her lips. She picked up her sunglasses and put them on despite the cloudiness of the day. Nanny watched her and smiled, a smile tightly bound by nerves and discomfort.
"It was nothing, madame,"
she said in the slow, delicate manner in which she had been training herself to speak whenever she spoke to non-Africans.
"You were a little sick, madame. I am glad I was able to come in and help you."
"But I wasn't sick," Cindy said. "I know you know that."
"I only thought..." "It's okay,"
Cindy said, raising her palm to silence her.
"You're a grown woman. There's no need to lie. I know you saw everything on the nightstand, and you didn't think I was just napping. You're smart enough to put 2 and 2 together. I could see in your eyes how scared you were."
"I did not see anything, madame."
"Yes, you did. And I'd rather you don't try to take me for a fool."
Nanny put her hands together on her lap and began rubbing them. She moved her eyes from Cindy's face to her own widening feet piling out of her blue flip-flops
and back to Cindy's face.
I did not, madame. I swear. I only thought you were sick. That is why I came this morning.